VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Southampton are booed off after their 1-0 defeat by Nottingham Forest at home. What did their fans expect Nathan Jones to deliver in his opening four Premier League matches? We'll talk about Leeds' match with West Ham United at Elland Road, which ended all square. Who was it a better point for, and which manager is under most pressure? There is certainly pressure at Goodison Park for Frank Lampard after their 4-1 defeat at home to Brighton. We'll ask what his prospects are for staying as manager. And we'll also review two games in London as Palace are heavily beaten by Spurs and Arsenal are held by Newcastle. This is The Game. Hello and welcome back to the Game Podcast. I am Hugh Wizencroft alongside Molly Hudson, Gregor Robertson and Tom Clark. Looking back at what's been a busy week of New Year's games, if you like, in the Premier League. We're going to start towards the bottom. I think there's a general relegation-induced theme to the podcast today with Southampton, who were booed off after a 1-0 home defeat to Nottingham Forest. The win means Forest are up to 15th. Southampton stay bottom, but they were, as I say, booed off by their fans who are calling for the manager to be sacked after they didn't have a single shot on target, despite it being just a fourth Premier League match in charge for Nathan Jones. James Ward-Prowse, their captain, asked the fans to bear with the team. He said it would take a little bit of time for things to improve, and I tend to agree with him. I think this was a bit of an overreaction from the fans. Sometimes things do get worse before they get better. Not always, but sometimes. New manager in a new division. Guess that gives the impression to the fans that maybe he's out of his depth. But actually, new methods might take just a little while for these players to get going. What are your thoughts, Gregor, particularly as you've seen much of Nathan Jones in the EFL?
Yeah, I mean, my instinct as well is that, you know, four games is not a fair period of time to judge a new manager. But I also understand the Southampton fans' extreme frustration at the performance last night, because as you say, failing to muster a shot on target in a game that was kind of basically a six-pointer. We're early in the season to call it a six-pointer, but there was 2 points between them before this game, and now they look, you know, rooted to the table, and Forest have climbed up to 15th. It's a big game. It's also completely fair that Jones is kind of bemoaning the nature of the goals they're conceding, which are embarrassing at times, and last night's was no different. Lianco gifted possession to Forrest basically around the halfway line, allowing Brennan Johnson just to gallop forward and lay on Awoniyi for the decisive goal. And then from that gives up, that, you know, I write again to say that gives Forrest the opportunity to sit in and soak up some pressure and play on the counter. But still, they had to offer more, and there were periods in the games where they were sending aimless balls into the box, often highly inaccurate balls just into Dean Henderson's hands. The fans were getting more and more frustrated, and at the end, it was toxic. They were screaming, "You don't know what you're doing." He kind of defiantly marched onto the middle of the turf, as we've seen so often from Jones. You know, when things were tough at Stoke, he was still out in the middle of the pitch, clapping all four stands, whatever reaction was coming his way. Or if they won, he would be, you know, beating his chest and roaring. And I'm sure when Southampton finally do get a win, they will see that from Jones. But it wasn't good. And he's had some time with them as well over the World Cup period to work in the training ground. And they don't really look like they are playing in a kind of coherent, balanced way. And they look a bit overawed by the task before them, and that's understandable when they're the youngest team in the Premier League as well.
I feel for Jones a little bit, Gregor, because some of the things you've alluded to there, he's got such a massive task on his hands because he's not just got the fans who have, you know, not taken against him, but they're aware of the wider significance of this. They're in a relegation scrap and they've made some dubious decisions, haven't they, in terms of the transfer market. Yes, they brought in some young talent, but they've also, it's not the most experienced squad. And they look a little bit lost on the pitch. So I feel for him in that sense. But I did find his comments after the game a bit strange. You know, I was reading your reports and, are you surprised by this? Not really. It doesn't concern me. It surprises me, but that's their prerogative. Like that, for a manager who's been given a huge opportunity as well, let's be honest, to step up to the Premier League, to a big club. You know, modern management is so much about your own PR, isn't it? And one of the huge tasks for someone like Jones in his position is surely get the fans on side. You know, be humble, be like, we need you. We need everyone to be with us at St. Mary's. We need everyone to be behind us. Like, I'm sure we'll come on to talk about them. But one of the good things Frank Lampard did last season in keeping Everton up was he got all the fans on side. And everyone talked about 12th man at Goodison, et cetera, et cetera. To put that kind of divide between you and the fans, to be like, oh, well, they can think what they want. I've always had it tough, blah, blah, blah. It's a weird tone to strike to me at this point in his career. Like, fine, even if you think, bloody tossers don't know what they're talking about, you know, not my fault. Even if you think that, don't do that in the press. Do the grovel, do the humble grovel. You know, I'm so excited by this opportunity, huge club. We need everyone behind us. You know the game. I don't know. I just found his comments quite strange in the position that he's in. It's adding, you know, you use the phrase toxic and he's adding to that, isn't he? Like, I thought it was a bit weird. What was it? Was he prickly in that sense?
He always is. He always has been, though. I mean, it was a little bit jarring when he said that because it was the second question he'd been asked about the reaction and he was asked, the question was, are you concerned as well? And he said, you know, no, not really. And, you know, clearly you've got to be concerned when after four games, your own fans are shouting, you don't know what you're doing. And yeah, it was a kind of, it was a strange tone to strike, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like belligerent. It was, I think he's just always someone who feels that when he's backed into a corner, he's going to fight for himself. And, you know, some of his comments after that, like saying, he was asked, is this the biggest challenge in your career? And he's like, look, I'm from a Welsh mining community. Everything I've done in my career has been a challenge, you know, whether it be in playing and becoming a coach and getting jobs coming through at Brighton, Luton, going back. He went through his whole, every job he'd inherited and where the club was, what position they were in. And he said, this isn't much different, but it is different because it's the Premier League. And he also alluded to it, that there's a perception, there seems to be a perception that he's maybe fortunate to be given this opportunity. That's also going to kind of count against him in terms of being given time by his own support.
I know we mentioned that there's only been four games, but I've just had a look at the fixtures that are coming up, and it's that sort of weird period where whatever else happened with Southampton, they're still in both cup competitions. They're still in the FA Cup, they're still in the EFL Cup. And it gives them a bit of a break until their next league fixture. But then their next league fixture is Everton. So suddenly, if you don't win one of those games, you're out of both cup comps and you've lost another sort of relegation six-pointer. And suddenly you're seven games in and you're thinking, you've got to do something now. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's only four games in, but you look at the next three games coming up and you think, how does he go on if he doesn't get something out of them? And that sounds really ridiculous. I know it does, saying, well, he's had seven games, that's not fair. But it's the Premier League. Like, we've seen weirder things happen, haven't we? And I think, you know, especially, I'm doing that game, Palace-Southampton on Saturday. I think that's a massive one because I think, realistically, you look at Man City in the Carabao, that's pretty much a free hit, isn't it? I don't think anyone's expected him to get anything out of that. So, yeah, you worry for him on the basis of how the fixtures have fallen. I think the ones that he's had so far were like reasonably winnable. And I think then to go into this next period and that big Everton game, if you don't get anything by the 14th of January, which again is ridiculous because it's like a week away or whatever. But yeah, you worry for him slightly.
I think I would say there is a little bit of me feeling like lots of things are coming home to roost here. It's not all on Nathan Jones. I think it is. That's why I think it's very unfair to expect the manager who, by the way, Ralf Hasenhüttl, we all think is a pretty good coach, They were a pretty bad team with him, and that's why he lost his job, obviously. But when you look at the recruitment, you think it's so boom or bust, to be perfectly honest. All of these young players, who I'm sure will have great futures, at this point in time, in this season, it's a hospital pass for any coach at this level of football. It's meant to be the toughest league in the world. We all think Bazunu's going to have a bright future. He was playing in League One. He's 20 years old. He's your number one goalkeeper. Sekou Mara, 19. He's come from Ligue 2 in France. Romeo Lavia, I spoke to a Belgian journalist out of the World Cup, thinks he's going to be their next great player. He's come from Manchester City. He's under 21s. He was 18 years old. Bella Kotchap, 20 years old. Edozi, another Man City under 21, 19 years old. I mean, Juan Larios, another Man City under 21, 18 years old. I mean, a lot of these players are not coming in to have a huge effect on your team. Okay, there was a bit of experience. 25-year-olds, Kaleta Sarr from Marseille, Aribo from Rangers. You know, but generally speaking, Maitland-Niles came in on a loan. Nothing special. With respect, it's boom or bust. If these young players are the next best thing and you've brought them all to your football club, then wow, incredible. They're all going to get sold in 2 or 3 years. You're going to make huge, huge profits. If they're not, you're getting relegated. That's the reality of it.
We said this at the start of the season, didn't we?
My point on the back of it was not just to slam their summer transfer, but to say, basically, in January, they need to go out and bring in, even if it's 6-month loan deals, experienced players at this level with quality. They're going to have to use their relative, you know, stability financially as a football club to bring in 3, 4, 5 probably players who can play in that first team, who've got experience, a little bit of nous to help get them through this. That's ultimately, if they don't, they're going down. Sorry, go on, Gregor.
No, look, I think you're absolutely right, but I'm not sure any of us would have much confidence that they're going to do that, particularly if you've just gone out and hired Nathan Jones. Like, there's a kind of overarching vision about how they want to run the football club, and that's not necessarily aligned with Premier League survival this year. That's the truth of the matter, and I think Southampton fans realise that, and they're angry about it because they want to see them maintain their Premier League status, and they feel that the decisions that are being made are not going a long way to helping them doing that.
So do you think they'd stick with it with Nathan Jones if they went down? Do you think he'd get that much time?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'd actually be more worried about him seeing out the rest of the season, given how bad it's going. I'm not, that sounds bizarre and, you know, crazy to say, but we've seen crazier things happen. I don't know if you can keep losing games and the stadium, the atmosphere turns kind of more and more toxic, how it could be sustainable. Look, we're only 4 in. I really hope he gets a result soon and they at least make a fight of it. But that's the immediate concern. And then, you know, if they do go down, of course they should stick with him. And I think they would, I think, because he's someone who's proved a canny operator at championship level. So, but look, that's for another day. The problem is in the here and now and getting their first points on the board under Nathan Jones.
I personally think he has to show something during this season in the Premier League that makes you think they're going to be a very good side in the Championship, or he won't be there next season. That's, of course, the big if they get relegated. Who knows? Things might turn around. But I think if they, a bit like Dean Smith at Norwich, okay, although Dean Smith kept his job, he probably shouldn't have, given he got nothing out of the Norwich City side in the Premier League last season. Like, all I'm saying is I think Nathan Jones does need to get a little bit of a tune out of this side, even if the worst happens at the end of the season, to be the manager next year in the Championship. Again, Southampton fans, we are not relegating you. We're not saying you're definitely going down. Very much a hypothetical situation. But anyway, that Southampton wrapped up. Very quickly, Tom Clark. Steve Cooper, Nottingham Forest, 1-7 in all competitions. This is another reason I thought the reaction was slightly overblown. I saw a lot of, we didn't get a shot on target against the worst defence in the league. Well, that's the old Nottingham Forest before these players bedded in. Clearly, they're not as bad as they were at the start of the year, conceding 4s and 5s. Okay, to be honest, I would have hoped to have a shot on target as well if I was a Southampton fan. But generally speaking, they're in good form. That's what I mean. I think it was slightly unfair to Nottingham Forest to almost cast them as this embarrassing football team when they're not really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing to say is they looked quite solid very early on. I remember that home game against West Ham. They won 1-0. They looked solid in that game. And I think a lot of people got slightly carried away, and it's to Cooper's credit that he's brought it back around. People got carried away with the idea that this huge squad of multi-talented players from various different parts of the world would not be able to gel. But he's managed to find the right blend of those players, the kind of the you know, your experienced players who he brought in, and then the more exciting players. I, for one, am obviously delighted that Brennan Johnson's still getting plenty of minutes. And look, not conceding goals is a massive, massive part of staying in the Premier League. And he looks to have found the right mix of those players to do that. So I'd say that's hugely encouraging. What will be interesting now is whether we've read reports recently of more players coming in, more spending in January. So whether that happens and we have to go through the whole cycle again of a couple of weeks of uncertainty, I don't know. I don't know whether Forest fans would look at their squad and think we need more players, because I actually think it looks like they've got a decent blend of talent, experience, grit, flair, all those kind of tropes that you trot out that you need in the Premier League. I would say they've got enough to have a good go at staying in the Premier League, I would say. But whether their ambitions are far greater than that, and as Gregor constantly refers to their ownership model and style and desires, I'm not sure. So we'll see. It could all change. But Cooper deserves huge credit for kind of settling all that down and making them pretty solid and hard to beat.
It was funny last night. He's asked questions about the game, and then someone said, "Steve, the January transfer window's open," and he just went, "Oh," I just like slammed his head down on the desk in front of him, and was like, "Oh, I don't want to think about that. You know, stop asking me about this, please," because he knows what's coming. It's been the whole narrative for, you know, their whole time in the Premier League. But it's a fair point. Like, they've already signed one player, Scarpa, who Brazilian midfielder who came off the bench last night, and whether he wants only a couple of players or not, I think unfortunately there's other people working in the background who have a bigger say than him over that. So you don't want the apple cart to be upset. The other things I asked him about, because I've made this point, I said, ever since they changed shape, it's been transformative. And I asked him about that, and he said, it was quite funny, his response. He's like, I thank you for your question. You know, we don't often get tactical questions, so thanks for that. And I was like, that was his first response. And then he said, but I'd actually just say it's more about the kind of the attitude and desire of the players and the way that they're working hard for each other. And so he's kind of more, we all look at that. That was a big turning point for them. They're conceding far fewer goals since the 4-0 defeat against Leicester. But he feels it's more about the fact that they know each other now, and they're a team. And it looked like that very much in the pitch. They were really, he said, they didn't feel at any point they looked like they were going to concede a goal. And I would have to echo that. They looked very solid and looked a threat on the break with Johnson, Awoniyi, you know, really powerful and quick on the break as well. And Gibbs-White is growing in stature with every passing week. So it's a good balance to the team. And absolutely, Forest have seemed to have turned a corner. Be interesting to see what happens in January now.
Well, two other sides met at Elland Road, who are, of course, most focused on staying in the Premier League. West Ham United snapping a 5-match losing run with a 2-2 draw at Leeds United. It was an entertaining match. I reckon both sides will feel that they could have won it. David Moyes, most importantly, I think, wasn't happy with the way that his side conceded. But as I say, I think it was an encouraging performance for both teams. How encouraging? What do you think?
Oh, good question. I would say probably more encouraging for West Ham in a strange way, in that they were the worst team of the two. Leeds looked, particularly in that second half, looked like they knew this was a must win for them, home game, and that West Ham were there for the taking. So I think for West Ham to get a point was pretty big for them. It was a strange one. You know, you mentioned Moyes not being happy with the defending. I think this is a fascinating season for West Ham. They've got players like Paqueta, Scamacca coming in, which suggests a change in dynamic, a change in style, if you like. But then you still have players like Koufal, Dawson in defence, players who were such a big part of what Moyes has done at West Ham, but who, you know, for that first goal, they looked a little off it. They looked a little sluggish, a little slow for that first Leeds goal. And I just wonder whether, you know, when you think of those two players, Koufal and Dawson, and then you think of others like Paqueta, whether Moyes is caught in between them, both in terms of style, both in terms of the players who historically he's worked best with. And I just wonder, I've been a huge fan of Moyes they've been one of my teams on this podcast that I've talked so much about in the last few years. But I wonder whether there's a pinch point now where will he get the time to have this transformational season to become a David Moyes and West Ham 2.0, where it is about the Paquetas and the Scamacchas, because at the minute it feels a bit muddled, and that's why they're going away at Leeds and being happy with a point, which probably came around from a bit of sloppy play from Leeds, Aaronson giving the ball away for Scamacca for that great finish. And the other point I'd like to make with West Ham is Moyes and a lot of West Ham fans have pointed to the injuries they've had a lot, particularly this season. But when you look at it, Zouma and Corne, yes, big players, big recent signings, would probably be in and around the team, but they're the only ones that are out now. They've got a fairly full squad to work with. So I would say, I don't know whether it was encouraging, but it was a more important point for them, I think, because I think if they'd lost at Leeds, that would have been pretty worrying for Moyes. For Leeds, as I say, I think it was pretty must win for them. And you could see the way they attacked in the second half. You could see Marsh's reactions on the touchline. They've got Villa, Forest, Everton and Saints, four of their next six Premier League games. So this is their season now in the next kind of 6 weeks or so. And this game was one of them. And you could kind of tell that Marsh has probably looked at the fixture list and gone, right, it's here. It's this. This is the point where we'll work out whether we're going to be scrapping away at the end of the season or whether we'll have pulled ourselves into that 13th, 14th. So in answer to your question, it was probably encouraging for neither of them. And it was a pretty disastrous point. They probably both could have done with winning the game. But I think marginally, West Ham will be the happier of the two.
As Tom was speaking there, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Liverpool, where we're kind of asking them to, like, go again. But I was at Liverpool Brentford on Monday night. I mean, I'm still in that period of Christmas. No idea what day it is. But kind of watching them do the same thing that they've done over Klopp's era, and now the players maybe aren't quite capable of doing it as they were before, and they need new, fresh players that have different strengths. And you look at kind of players like Harvey Elliott, for example, that are kind of blending into that team now. I think it's a little bit similar at West Ham, in a sense of that those players that they're brought in, they're not very Moyesy signings, are they, in a way? Like, I don't think Paqueta, having watched him at the World Cup for Brazil, obviously an incredible team, but I don't think we've seen anything near that from him at West Ham. And I always go back to Saeed Benrahma when he was at West Ham, came to West Ham, a lot of sort of excitement around him. It's never really worked. And you always got the impression that kind of Moyes was a bit annoyed sometimes with that kind of attacking player. Obviously, there's a level of percentage counts of the things that they do working or not working. And I think Moyes naturally has always had that sort of safer approach, and that's kind of what worked for West Ham for a lot of those players. And now the players that they have brought in are sort of lower percentage players that have a higher, like, ceiling, if that makes any sense. And with that, obviously you're going to have times where it works and times where it doesn't. And I think obviously this season it hasn't really worked, and it's quite interesting, particularly with Leeds, when you listen to Jesse Marsh, you feel like they've got a project and a plan. And I know not everyone likes Jesse Marsh, and he's sort of very energetic, very sort of like has this thing in his mind. But you see where they're going with it, and he really believes in it. And I don't know if you were saying about Moyes 2.0, Tom. I don't know if, like, Moyes believes in a Moyes 2.0 with that club, with that squad at the minute. Do you know what I mean? And I think, I also don't know if the fans believe in that at the moment. So I think in terms of having a project and a sort of way of doing it with someone like Klopp at Liverpool, you're Klopp at Liverpool. Like, you've earned so much that you're kind of allowed to be a bit rubbish for a bit. And don't get me wrong, Moyes has done a fantastic job at West Ham. Some of the things they've done, particularly in Europe, but I just don't know if, you know, it's pretty rare to have stored up the amount of good credit that Klopp has at Liverpool for any manager to can kind of compete with.
Yeah, it's interesting, Molly, that you make the point about my Moyes 2.0 thing, because I also was thinking about it in prep and was thinking about comparisons with Leicester maybe and Brendan Rodgers, and the fact, you know, the time whether he's had to go through, you know, Leicester and West Ham had similar levels of success in different ways with Moyes and Rodgers. And now they're both, you know, still there needing a second gear. But I guess the difference is, as you say, the next iteration of Moyes and West Ham perhaps needs a completely change in style, whereas Rodgers is just looking for new players, fresh talent, and is widely regarded as a coach that plays quite attractive football and, you know, brings young players through and lets those attacking players that you mentioned have chance to flourish. So that's the challenge for Moyes. But I would say, in his defense, when you think about his career, perhaps he's never had the chance to do 2.0. Yes, he was at Everton for a long time, but he was at Everton a long time and did the same thing well over and over again, didn't he? You know, he bought all those players, the same kind of players. And this is the first time, you know, then went to Manchester United, pretty disastrous. After that, stuck, you know, middled around. This is the first time he's got back to that kind of Everton stage of success and, you know, respect for his career. I would just be fascinated to see whether he gets the time and whether maybe we go through a year and this time next season, he'll still be there. West Ham won't have got relegated, that he'll have had a full year with the Paquetas of this world. And we will have seen whether, because this is his chance. He might not get another chance to do the reinvention of David Moyes. This might be his only chance. So I'd be really excited. No, really excited. That's, I'm getting a bit carried away. I'd be really interested to see whether he gets the chance to do it.
Yeah, look, I think for me, when it comes to West Ham United, I just there's an element with David Moyes of, we know what to do, we just need to do it. You know, there isn't this feeling that he's going to suddenly, you know, reinvent the wheel, bring out an eight-sided dice, or, you know, he's got something up his sleeve, a dove's going to fly out. You know, there isn't that element to him of, you know, of just changing the script. And I think it is one of those where he'll stick to it and over time the players will get used to it more. But I do think it is a test for him as a coach, because you bring in talents like Paqueta, someone who was highly regarded in Scamacca, who scored a brilliant goal. But you need to get a tune out of them. And to be honest, on Benrahma, I think he's got more out of him of late than he has certainly in the first part of his West Ham United career. I think probably they'll go into January and pick up someone like Ben Brereton-Diaz from Blackburn Rovers. I think that's a possibility. Someone that can just inject something, some life into the team over the second part of the season. And I think we all think they'll have enough to stay up in the Premier League. I don't think that's going to be a concern. I just think they've set a high bar, particularly top half finishes, and the West Ham United fans will want that. And I think if you're going to keep players like Declan Rice, you need to show that you're going somewhere as sort of difficult as that will probably be for them. So, I'm fine with David Moyes at West Ham United, but that's as excited, Tom Clark, as I'm going to get, okay? Let's move on. Another team that is very, very threatened by relegation is Everton. And the situation there worsened. They were beaten 4-1 by Brighton at Goodison Park. The home side booed down the tunnel at half-time and at full-time as well. Paul Joyce reports in the Times that Frank Lampard will take charge of Everton's FA Cup tie with Manchester United on Friday. But his long-term job prospects remain in the balance. We'll talk about Lampard in a second. Gregor, were Brighton great in this game or were Everton just rubbish?
I don't think Brighton had to be great all game. I think they had a flurry in the second half in which they were excellent. But Everton, you're looking at the goals, Everton's defending is just so passive. I think it was the third Solly Marches where Brighton player was running across the box and James Tarkowski was kind of following him across. He seemed to be the only player who was willing to try and close down. Yeah, as you can see, Tom demonstrating what I'm about to say here. And then he slipped at the kind of crucial moment and he was flapping around like a fish on the floor trying to get something in front of an imminent shot from Solly March. But no, you know, there was people around him doing very little. Like, he seemed to be the only player with any commitment to actually putting his body on the line to stop Everton conceding a goal. You know, it was, the same is true of a number of other goals. Evan Ferguson kind of found too much space in the box far too easily for his goal. Yeah, I speak about it a lot. I think passive defending is kind of when a club or and a team and a group of players are feeling the pressure and they're, you know, low in confidence, everyone's just making gestures to try and seem like they're doing their job. And that is lethal. You've got no chance when that's the case. No one is really trying to go and win the ball. You know, Everton's defending was just woeful. It was just a game where you'll watch it and you think, this is a, you know, such a striking contrast between these two clubs in every department, whether it's, you know, the way they run overall, the recruitment, their kind of transition, the transition between coaches and managers. De Zerbi's just come in and hit the ground running straight away, really. In terms of performances, it took a while to get the results to match them, but they've They've performed brilliantly from basically from day one, and there's so much to admire about Brighton, and it really is a kind of a bit of a reminder of what Everton are doing badly. That's what this game was, I think. If you're an Everton fan, you watch Brighton, you think, why can't we be have even, you know, half of their intelligence in the way we've run our football club since Farhad Moshiri bought the club and spent £500 million on players so badly. It must be really chastening for them.
I'm delighted Hugh made it a two-pronged question as well there, because it ensured that we didn't do the whole thing of talk for Everton about five, 10 minutes, and then do, by the way, Brighton, amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Which is basically a catchphrase on this and every podcast and every bit of analysis in the Premier League, isn't it, for the last few years? By the way, Brighton, weren't they brilliant? So I'm glad we got that in there. But on Everton, Gregor, you talk about passive defending. I thought, you know, another word was the intensity. The Idrissa Gueye back pass, you look at his body, the shape of his body, the way he hits the ball. It, like, fine, it's a terrible pass, but there's no purpose there. There's no, like, thought of, right, bang this back to the keeper, then get upfield, or just turn. You've got time. Turn. It, like, so lacking in intensity. And it made me think, all the conversation around the World Cup and players being tired and the, you know, the amount of work and travel and stuff, Everton have got a squad pretty unharmed by the World Cup, let's be honest. And so you've got a group of players there that have had a break, probably had a chance to do some mid-season training, maybe warm weather training. Lampard's had the chance to get in amongst the group. And that is the real worry for me, that that intensity is lacking in terms of both the way they play, but also the desire. As you say, when it is James Tarkowski doing the hero dive to try and block a shot, that looks pretty worrying. And one point I just wanted to make, because you alluded to it there, Gregor, with the recruitment and the contrast between Brighton and Everton, is when you look at Brighton with Ferguson playing up front and scoring and looking really bright, and with Everton, you've then got Ellis Sims on the bench, young forward, had some time in the Football League, was at Blackpool when they got promoted, then went to Sunderland, was doing really well, had an injury, but has been scoring goals for Sunderland. But in terms of his career development, was on the right path. And then Everton need goals, recall a striker that's probably not ready for the Premier League. He's on the bench. Is he going to be playing a big part in the rest of this season? No. So you've then harmed the development of a player who was yours and could have maybe been good next season and not really benefited yourself in any way. And as you say, Gregor, when you look at Brighton and how they bring players through, give them the opportunities, either loan them out in a very tactical way, I just thought that was such a stark contrast with those two young players in forward positions, that it's just another facet of where Everton are going wrong.
Ferguson was, you know, really impressive once again. I remember I saw him against Forest Green Rovers in the cup at the start of the season. I think he was only 17 at that point, and he, you know, it wasn't rocket science, but I think I came on and said, remember the name, because he's so powerful and so, I don't know, he just looked so at ease in the men's game for such a young lad. And he's proved it now in the last two games. He's been really impressive. I was down at Brighton interviewing Alexis McAllister earlier in the week, and spoke to De Zerbi after as well. And he was kind of, you know, when he was asked about Ferguson, he was like nodding his head, saying he's some player. He's got a big future, and he's ready to play in the starting 11 now. And he's proved it again. He's I thought he was outstanding. But we also have to say, I think Mitoma is going to be a star. He was another one who played down at Forest Green that day. There was three of them. There was those two and Enisco, who came on yesterday as well. Another young player, I think from Colombia. You know, there's another three players who just come from nowhere, really. And, you know, they'll be drip fed into the team, but they're making an impact. And yeah, there's so much to admire about Brighton.
Mitoma is just a lot of fun, isn't he? I think he kind of drip feed into the team is a great way of describing it, because I think he is that player at the moment that looks better when he comes off the bench, and I think we saw it for Japan quite a lot of the World Cup as well. He's just a box of tricks. He's fun. He gets the fans off their seat, and he looks like he can be a really great player. And I suppose as you were saying, kind of the difference between the two teams is that it feels like Brighton just have this recruitment, and, you know, of course it blends in with the way that they run the club, but they do it, you know, it's not a coincidence that we're talking about these young players coming into the team, hitting form. It's the right environment for them to obviously be in the team and feel as though they're part of it. But also De Zerbi has been, you know, it's how many times have we seen it where a manager leaves when it's not disastrous? That's pretty rare in the Premier League, right? Quite often the turnover in jobs is when things have gone wrong and they're having to rebuild. It must have been quite difficult for De Zerbi to come in and kind of live up to what Graham Potter had done, because he'd obviously done a fantastic job at Brighton. And I think what we've seen is how well De Zerbi has picked up on that. And I think maybe that's gone under the radar a little bit, that actually it's not like he come into a club that was struggling and has given them this boost. He was come into a club that was already doing well and a group of players that were already doing well. And clearly the players in that dressing room have really kind of picked up on the philosophy that he's come in with and the way they're playing. And, you know, they're, if anything, I think I enjoy watching Brighton more under De Zerbi than I did under Potter, I think I would say.
Yeah, slightly more on the front foot. You know, it seemed to be slightly more patient build-up play with, under Potter. And they still dominate most games in terms of how much possession they have, but there's just seems to be a little bit more attacking purpose. And I think he's done an outstanding job so far.
We shall see if that continues for Brighton, and we'll see if Everton's poor form continues as well. One win in 10 Premier League games, Manchester United in the FA Cup, and then the matches with Southampton and West Ham. They look like must-win games for Frank Lampard's future, so we'll keep a close eye, of course we will, on Everton in the coming weeks. Let's head up to the other end of the table, shall we? Spurs are in fifth place, rampant in the second half at Crystal Palace. They ran out 4-0 winners. Maybe a scoreline that slightly flattered them, but they were well worth their victory. Palace were wasteful in front of goal. Harry Kane wasn't. Two goals on the night made it 198 in 300 Premier League games. And a player like him, Molly, will always give you hope. And maybe in the second half of this season, Spurs' hopes will be pinned on him.
Yeah, and I think it was the kind of game where, as you say, Palace had been quite wasteful in that first half. I don't think anybody could have argued too much if Palace had gone in at half-time ahead. And I think once Kane sort of scored that first goal, it is the difference between the team like Spurs, whether or not they're going to make top four or anything like that. They have those players that are just world-class, which a team like Palace don't quite have, that sort of mid-table team. There's a lot of exciting things going on at Palace, and I'll bang that drum, and I did it at the weekend, which hasn't aged too well. I think there's a lot of young players there, players like Michael Olise, Eberechi Eze. They've got really bright futures, but they're kind of, and I actually wrote in that piece that when you have young players like that, they're going to have ups and downs. And I know Patrick Vieira has talked about it and is aware of that as well, I think it's fair to say. Whereas when you have players like Kane, they just show up day in, day out in those big moments. It happens. Somehow he finds the goal. And I think that was the big difference in a way. It wasn't a 4-0 game. The margins between the two teams were not 4-0, but players like Harry Kane make it a 4-0 game because he's just so clinical. And I think that's probably the thing that will keep Spurs quite happy in a way, is that they've got Kane. Even when the whole Conte show is going on, it's a bit dramatic. Will he stay? Will he not? Whatever. Harry Kane, solid, reliable, will get you goals.
I just wanted to say on Palace before we come back to Tottenham, I think Molly makes a really interesting point, because I was watching this game and the thing that struck me was it wasn't a 4-0 game, but as a neutral and perhaps as a Palace fan, it was so much more engaging to watch because of the way they played. But because of the way they played and some of the players they have in that team meant they lost 4-0. And I thought if this had been Roy Hodgson's Crystal Palace, they might have lost 1-0 or maybe 2-0. And it would have been a bit tighter and we'd be talking about, oh, it's a close game. But would it have been more as exciting? And would they have 22 points? And would they have Eze and Olise in the same team trying to play intricate passes that sometimes come off and create a chance for Zaha and sometimes they don't? So again, it comes back. We've referenced it with West Ham. We've referenced it with Everton, with Brighton. You know, Palace are another one. What do you want to be? And I think they're in the right place with Vieira and with these young players. And they will occasionally get beat 4-0 at home by a team that's got a Harry Kane in it. And I think that's okay, because I think they'll be fine. I think they'll stay up. And I really hope that all those things I've just talked about keep coming true, because they're a lovely team to watch, and there's a lot to like about them as a club as well.
The expected goals is 1.39, 0.79. Everything you're saying is absolutely true. Spurs just had Harry Kane. I know how many times have we said that. I liked Tom Allnutt's opening line in his piece here. It was basically, for the first time in 11 games, Spurs scored first and the rest was pretty easy. And it's like, we have to remind ourselves this is the first time in 11 games that Spurs have taken the lead, and how much that dynamic changes what follows. You know, if you keep going behind, it plays havoc with your mind and the way you have to approach the game. And sometimes I've seen Spurs go, well, I think in 7 of those games, Spurs went too behind and they really have to throw everything at it to get to find a point, at least. When they've got Harry Kane this clinical, when they take the lead, and it wasn't comfortable. Lloris had to make some good saves, but it's just it makes such a difference when you've got something to hold on to, essentially. And Conte looked much, much happier after the game.
He did, but he's still annoying me. In the build-up to the match, Antonio Conte, if you don't want to be the manager, just leave, to be perfectly honest, because he keeps casting doubt over his future. Okay, he says, my task here is to help the club to build a solid foundation, to create a base, and then try to improve. This is my task here. This is my challenge here. If you ask me, and the challenge for you is to win the Premier League, to win the Champions League, this is not the task here at the moment. Once again, I think, telling the fans, stop complaining. Once again, telling the board, give me more money if that's what you really want. The question I have to ask you is, when will it stop? When will it stop? Listen, if I'm the Tottenham board, offer the guy a new contract, and if he stalls and he stalls and he stalls, you know, people can say he's top tier, you know, he's a brilliant coach. Yeah, okay, he is. But if you can't support him to be a brilliant coach and you as a club can't do it, you need to get a manager that suits you. Like, ultimately, that's it. You can't have your manager coming out every single week moaning about either a lack of funds or the fact that this club can't win big trophies, and that's what he wants to do. And if it wasn't for Tottenham Hotspur holding me back, well okay then, go and manage Inter Milan.
But the thing I talked early on about Nathan Jones and his poor PR. This, at least from a PR point of view, is Conte sticking to brand Conte. Let's be honest, he's nothing if not consistent. So you've got to praise him for that, surely, Hugh. But I think it's interesting, you know, he's talking about, if you want us to win the Champions League, if you want us to win the league. He's not talking about that anymore. What he's actually talking about, but he won't say out loud because it's bad PR, is, do you want us to finish in the top four? Because now he's competing with a more resurgent Manchester United. He's competing with Newcastle. He doesn't know whether Liverpool and Chelsea will come. And he knows he ultimately, base level, needs to get in the top four again. Otherwise, it's going to look terrible for him. So he's saying title. He's saying compete at the very top. What he's actually doing is he's looking around him and going, oof, this is going to be tough to finish fourth, let alone third, which is what so many people predicted for us at the start of the season. It's good PR. It's consistent Conte, man. I'm backing him all the way.
In all seriousness, though, Spurs are at a big juncture here, I think. I was speaking about this with an editor the other day. You know, you have to throw so much money at Conte. He demands it. You have to throw money and money, money at him to sign players, often experienced players. It's not really with one eye on the future. It's for the here and now to win. And then even if you do win, if it brings success, he demands more or he leaves. And it's like, so there's never any semblance of any sort of look into the future, really. It's all about here and now and winning. And so Spurs have basically got to decide whether they're happy to do that or not, whether they want to back him and see if he can take them to that, to some silverware, which they really, really, really want, you know, after the, you know, given their, considering their history with silverware. But, you know, what, there's still a question then, what would come next? He's not going to stick around. You just have to, you know, and build something. He would demand more money, because he would say that you need it to keep doing it year after year, and or else he'd walk away. And he might walk away anyway. Look at Juventus, look at Chelsea, look at Inter Milan. You know, none of them were in a great position when he left. So I actually, you know, we can laugh about it, and it is comical, because it's kind of, all right, Antonio, we've heard this so many times now, mate. Like, you know, give it a rest. We know what your ulterior motives here. But Spurs need to decide. They need to decide what they want to be and whether they want to give him the money he needs.
It felt like when Tottenham hired first Jose Mourinho, then Antonio Conte, they made a decision that they were moving away from a kind of project manager like Pochettino into a club that was, right, we're sick of this. We haven't won a trophy in however many years. We're going to win, right? And in making that decision, sort of accepted in a way that maybe it wouldn't be as pretty or whatever. You wouldn't have, you know, loads of young players. And I think, however you feel about Mourinho and Conte, there are some similarities there in a sense. But then you hear him say, well, we're not going to win a trophy. Well, what's the point then? Go back to a Pochettino, or, I mean, maybe that's actually unfair on current Pochettino, but a sort of Pochettino he was before he came to Spurs, somebody that you gamble on building a project with, bringing young players through, bringing an identity through. And then in that sense, we've got a lower chance of a trophy, but more of a sort of progression. At the minute, they're getting the bad side of Mourinho and Conte, which is big egos, big PR, lots of noise without actually winning anything, which, let's not forget, was the point of hiring them.
I get everything you're saying, and I've had enough of it. So Antonio Conte, make your mind up, mate. Listen, if I'm on the board of Tottenham Hotspur, I've got to say, you know, this contract needs to be signed pretty soon, doesn't it? You know, you're either going to be staying for the long-term future and we can invest in you, your squad and your approach over the next 4 or 5 years, even if it's a 4-year, 3-year deal, whatever, you got some clarity. But at this point in time, there isn't enough. There isn't enough clarity. There isn't enough commitment on his part to be saying what he's saying to the club. And I do think there's a strange power dynamic where this is one of the few clubs, I think, where the manager is basically saying, I'm more important than you. I am more important than the football club. We often say that no player is more important than the club. Well, the manager is essentially saying here, oh, you can only have success with me. It's almost like your club is nothing without me. I don't like it. I just don't like it. So sign the contract, Antonio. Put pen to paper. Commit your future, you know, and then we can talk. But at this point in time, you're starting to feel like he's a bit of a want-away coach, if that's a thing. Yeah, I just don't like it. Okay, so let's sort the future out. Let's go and spend some money together. Get ourselves a lovely Ferrari and drive it off into the sunset. Until that point in time, we just can't be friends.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Before we leave the podcast, we've left this game right until the end. This is meant to be the big game of the last few days. We know we've still got a big one coming between City and Chelsea, but it was a bit of a drab affair, characterised by a card-happy referee and a time-wasting Newcastle United. Yes, their trip to Arsenal ended goalless. I think we expected a little bit more than that. Arsenal fans very unhappy with the ball only being in play for 51 minutes and 23 seconds according to Opta, which is the 34th lowest of all Premier League games this season. Also, the Arsenal boss Mikel Arteta felt his team really should have had at least one penalty. He thought there was a pull on Gabriel. Yes, maybe. The handball shout late on, not for me, Clive. I don't know what we found out about both of these two sides. I think we've maybe found out that Newcastle do have the potential to really put the cat amongst the pigeons, even when they don't play particularly well. There is a bit of nous in that squad, it seems. It was also a difficult night for Arsenal, granted, up against pretty much the best defence in the league. You know, when it doesn't click perfectly for them, we didn't see a side that had a plan B fighting their way to victory, if you like. Now, maybe, you know, the big caveat here is maybe they could have got a bit of help from the referee. All in all, I thought it was a fair point, even though the fairness comes from one side's endeavour to score and the other side's quality, if you like, in resisting that. But Gregor, what did you make of the game at the Emirates?
Yeah, I think you've summed it up pretty well. I think that Newcastle demonstrated their resilience and how well coached they are as well. I mean, very few wingers in the Premier League you see putting in a defensive shift as well as Joe Ellington and Almiron. You know, doubling up, helping out Dan Burn and Trippier, the fullbacks. You know, you thought Dan Burn was going to have a tough night when Saka skipped past them in the first 5 minutes, but they kind of largely nullified them. And, you know, you mentioned about how much, you know, the ball was in play. I recommend Martin Hardy's piece about that. Which is in the Times just now. That's commonplace this season in their away games. I think basically that's their average, which is the second lowest of any team in the Premier League. And he linked that to some time that Howe spent with Diego Simeone, the Atletico Madrid manager, during his time out of work. So he's obviously learned some of the dark arts. You know, he saw Jamal Lascelles being booked for the second time this season as a substitute for blocking a throw-in towards the end. This is a new Eddie Howe, and I'm here for it. And from Arsenal's point of view, I think I said on Thursday, it's the step down from their starting and their best 12 or 13 players is big. They've made the fewest changes of any team in the Premier League, and I think we can see why. And we saw that they didn't really have any options that you thought, we've got this to change the game, or, you know, someone else of kind of a similar standard who can come in and make a difference. So that's what Arsenal need to change, I think, probably in January. And I also thought that Arteta's antics on the touchline were pretty embarrassing, particularly for the handball, because it was a marginal handball. And he's running screaming at the fourth official. Go on, Tom. I can see you want to speak about this.
Leave it out, will you? Honestly. I knew. I was thinking, this is nice, you know, quite considered tactical analysis, bit of praise for Newcastle, bit of analysis of the squad depth at Arsenal. I was thinking, no one's pinged old Mikel yet. And then here he comes from long range on his long run, Grumpy Scott. Honestly, I'm just not having it. He's done absolutely nothing wrong. For years, we've like seen, enjoyed, loved Jurgen Klopp. Jurgen Klopp has literally made his name at Liverpool for running up. He ran on the pitch at one point. And,
yeah,
like,
but you've got,
jumped
there's got to
on
be
Alice.
Some justification for the thing that you claim
of course there's a justification.
Come
He's
on.
Literally top of the league with a squad that people were like, oh, he'll do well if he gets fourth. He's top of the league. He's got a genuine shot
That's
at winning the title.
That's nothing to do with the handball.
Yeah, it is, because the handball is a difference between 3 points and 1 point. Against the team, by the way, who are third.
It was ridiculous.
You've got a genuine claim there for that being a handball. I don't think it was. But if you're the manager of the team going for the title at home, you're perfectly within your rights to go a bit mental. Like, I just don't get it. He's also, in his defence, he's had to work through the years of boos, defeats, players storming off, the Aubameyangs. He's got Xhaka walking off at the Emirates to boos. Now, he's got this team on side. He's got Arsenal fans, man. Arsenal fans on side. How's he done that? Arsenal fans are never on side with anyone. They didn't even like Wenger at the end. He's got them on side. Like, fine, let him whip them up into a frenzy. That's what it's all about. Like, let him do it. He and Arsenal have got a genuine shot at winning this league. Let them lose the plot a bit. Let them lose the plot. I don't care. Like
yeah,
I
I've
think
got,
leave him
I've
leave
no
him
problem
be.
With him. I've no problem. You know, I absolutely agree. He's been outstanding, and I have no problem with him kind of whipping the crowd up. But all I'm saying is, to go to that extent, to be, you know, in the face of the fourth official, to be riling Eddie Howe, to be like getting into just about, you know, having to be pulled apart over that was a nonsense. To do it with a penalty claim, no problem. That was a penalty.
Ah, but it's all, you know, it's all part. It's all part of the set. You can't, in that moment, in a 6 yard area, sorry, in a technical area, go, no, that perhaps only justifies a little angry fist.
Okay,
bump,
make a
know.
Claim,
it,
but then get
it's
it
the
up
same.
And watch the game.
It's the same. It's the same, mate. Come on. Like, I went to watch Lincoln Klingon for a point at Ipswich and treated the last 5 minutes like it was the end of the world. this is modern football. This is what we've created. It's mad. It's stupid. It makes absolutely no sense. And I will not have people have a go at Mikel Arteta. Crack on, Mikel. They're just jealous, mate. They're just jealous.
Makes me sick, personally. Oh,
you wish. Just because you've got boring Eric Ten Hag.
If it's Jose, we're slamming him.
No.
Klopp's already got banned for it. I say it time and time again. You know, you get people copying this at Sunday League. You get people copying this.
No, I don't think it was
in
that.
Kids football.
You do.
It wasn't.
I agree. You do get people copying it. I don't think you're an old man. You're very young. But I don't think this was that level. I agree. There's an extent of where if people are going aggressive, I don't think this was. I think this was someone just losing the plot in the moment and looking a bit stupid. And he knows he'll look stupid, but I don't mind it. I don't think this was of the level that you're talking about, Hugh. I agree what you're referring to is a problem.
This ain't the first time we've been talking about Mikel Arteta's behaviour when it comes to officials. Yeah, he learned it all from Pep, whatever. You know, Jurgen Klopp does it. You know, I even spoke about the fact that Graham Potter isn't that on the touchline and maybe he should be. We spoke about Gareth Southgate being quite muted during the World Cup as well.
Alex Ferguson did it all career.
Yeah. But
he did quite well off the back of it as well.
Yeah.
You got to listen. I don't mind the claims, but that made out that there was a huge error on the part of the officials. It's like, come on, it was a cross that hit the elbow of a player. Come on.
He does it for every tackle too, and that pisses me off. You like, you know, any challenge that's like, you know, in any way near close to full blooded, and he's always doing that. He's throwing. I know this doesn't come over on a podcast well, but he's always throwing his arms at the officials. And look, I'm all for passion. We're maybe going a bit too much into this, but I just think you could choose your times to do it. And I think he's ridiculously one-eyed.
He's still learning, though. He's still learning. And I that's why I'll defend him as well. He's still learning. He's still very young.
Yeah.
And this is the first. And I do think there's a part of what I said where he's had to go through that difficult period and he's now finally got everyone within the club
absolutely
pushing in his direction. And if part of that is, you know, looking like, oh my God, we're going to win the title, creating that kind of culture of, oh, the decisions went against us. It comes back to it again. It's a bit of PR. It's fine. I can see Molly smiling away. I know she's on my side, aren't you, Mol?
I'm just laughing at you being very pro Moyes, pro Arteta, just very pro managers today, aren't you?
Listen, I just stick by my boys. That's, I've said it for the last few seasons. I'm going to stick with them.
Final point on this, Molly, for you. Who is it a better point for, a bigger point for, Arsenal or Newcastle, do you think? Not just on the balance of what we saw during the game, but just the context of the season.
I think probably Newcastle, but what I would say is I think if you look at both Arsenal and Newcastle seasons, they're both doing slightly better than, not that we didn't believe in Newcastle's project or that we didn't believe in Arteta's project at Arsenal, because we both know that they're heading in that upward trajectory. But I think both have maybe exceeded expectations in terms of quite how quickly they've done it. You know, we mentioned Arteta maybe aiming for top four this season, maybe next season or the one after's the real title challenge. For Newcastle, maybe it's sort of Europa League this season, not Champions League. And now suddenly they're in like genuine top four contention. And I think maybe this is what you saw in this game, this 0-0, was that both of them are, for everything amazing that they've done this season, they're just missing that little bit that would make them. So in Newcastle's sense, I think they're still having to dig in and defend against a team like Arsenal. Whereas when they're more rounded in their project, they'll be able to go toe-to-toe. And I, you know, fully back Eddie Howe in what he did in that game because it worked fantastically. But in 2 years' time, they'll expect more. They'll want to go toe-to-toe with Arsenal and, you know, attack them and, you know, completely. Arsenal, I think, as Gregor said, are just missing that bit of squad depth. Again, because they've sort of almost skipped a phase in their sort of development because of how well they've done this season. Now they're having to catch up. They're having to catch up in the transfer market. So I think both teams have flaws that they've covered up really well this season. And I think maybe in this game, this 0-0, you saw those flaws. And that's why neither of them were quite good enough to get the win.
Okay, Molly, thank you very much for that well-rounded assessment of what's to come for Arsenal and Newcastle. Gregor Robertson and Tom Clark, And Molly Hudson, thank you very much for your company. Thank you all for listening as well. FA Cup third round weekend, one of the best in the domestic calendar, is ahead of us. We'll react to that on Monday. Loads of great fixtures for us to sink our teeth into. By the way, loads of interesting previews ahead of that weekend and all of the reaction. Make sure you download the Times app. Pick up a newspaper, as always, of course, that old school thing that you can still do. But also you can subscribe to the game online at thetimes.co.uk/the game. We'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.